Talk Cheese.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with Pastor William Fink, on another installment of Christogenos. And since I was not available last Friday, I'm just going to turn it over to Bill for any updates from last time. I understand we're going to proceed into Ezekiel chapter 40. Any updates or review that you want to go through before we get into 40, Bill?
Well, I have a little bit, not too much about the previous weeks. You know, we covered Ezekiel 38 and 39, and I think I was able to pretty well demonstrate that Ezekiel 38 and 39 are very much parallel to Revelation chapters 18 and 19.
Okay.
They're talking about the same thing, that the surrounding and infiltration of the Israelite, the Christian white world, by all of the enemies of God, all of the alien races, and that's what Ezekiel 38 and 39 explain,
mm-hmm.
and that's what Revelation chapters 19 and 20, especially 20, explain.
Okay.
And if I've been called a papist lately by clowns in certain circles,
a papist
for claiming that the thousand-year reign of Christ was actually during the Middle Ages. History proves that out.
Yes.
Scriptural interpretation proves that out. These people are fools for thinking that the thousand-year reign is in the future,
mm-hmm.
and then that Christ himself could be overthrown for one
right.
moment by Gog and Magog 1,000 years after he throws them into the lake of fire.
Right.
I mean, that is a Catholic interpretation of Scripture.
Yes, exactly.
That is the interpretation formulated by the Jesuits in the Middle Ages,
yes.
because they did not, that they wanted to try to steer people out of believing that the medieval church had become the second beast of Revelation. Now, that
the Catholic
is the truth.
Church, yes.
But the Catholic Church, even though it was never 100% good, it did excoriate the Jew.
Right.
Put the devil into the pit
right.
for 1,000 years. There's very clear and precise historical documentation proving that.
Right.
It's a very clear view of that prophecy, and it really can't be gainsaid unless you are trying to cover for the Jews.
Right.
So the
right.
people that are accusing me of misinterpreting these scriptures, they are running cover for the Jews, and they
yes.
are the papists. They
agree.
Are following the interpretations that Clifton has long ago demonstrated from their own writings has come from the Jesuits.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's the Catholic Church that invented both preterism to, on the one hand, to try to claim that all the prophecies were fulfilled in 70 AD and therefore the Antichrist can't be the Catholic Church, right? And then they also invented futurism to suggest, well, it can't be the Catholic Church because it's way off in the future after the judgment day, right? So either way, the papacy is off the hook.
That's the whole point. That's the whole point. And the papacy, even though that the early imperial, let me call it imperial because that's basically what it was from the time of Justinian,
uh-huh.
the early imperial church, they made a lot of mistakes.
Right.
But they did put Satan into the pit for 1,000 years. And
right.
that's what we're focusing on here, discussing Revelation chapter 20. And the emergence of Satan has caused the deception of the whole world. And nobody can tell me that the whole world isn't deceived right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, and the emergence of Gog and Magog and all of our enemies. And we're surrounded by them as we speak.
Right.
And that's, I mean, all one has to do is open his eyes and see that all of those prophecies have come true, and that prophetic interpretation is the correct interpretation.
Right, right.
Now,
while I was at your house, you explained to me that one verse in Revelation 20, I believe verse 5.
Yes.
Is it verse 5, why that does not belong in the verse? And that's the questionable one that talks about the first resurrection.
Well, right, and the truth is without doubt that the where it talks about the resurrection in Revelation chapter 20, where it talks
yes.
about the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were up,
yes.
that line is not a part of the original text by
okay.
any means. It emerged out of the 8th or 9th century, and a commentator on a Revelation named Andreas of Caesarea.
Okay.
Now, even though it made its way into the King James Version of the Bible, the coin manuscript tradition itself is split on that verse. And the preponderance of coin manuscripts, coin Greek manuscripts, the minuscules, all the manuscripts that are considered to be the majority text that the Textus Receptus is based on,
okay.
the preponderance of coin Greek manuscripts of that variety do not have that sentence.
Okay. Okay.
And
so
that's the very easily
belong.
Demonstrated. Yes.
Right. So nothing earlier than 900 A.D. states that the first resurrection occurs in verse
5. Well it's the only words in chapter 20 of verse 5 that are in the text are where it says, this is the first, and now let's interpret the word, the Greek word, should be restoration. It shouldn't be resurrection.
Okay.
This is
oh.
the first restoration.
Okay.
That is the beginning and end of Revelation 20, verse 5.
Okay. Okay.
Where it says the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years
uh-huh.
were up, that was added to
that
the text.
Was added. So the 1,000-year part was added by the scribe around 900 AD.
Well, right, and the connection of that, the word may also be interpreted resurrection. However, when you add the dead and living again, that would force one to interpret that word to mean resurrection. Okay? But the word literally means restoration. And without the references that were added in to the dead and living again,
right.
we can translate that word restoration and see what it's intoning is the restoration of Adamic hegemony on the earth
right.
over Satan.
Yes.
Okay? And when Satan crawled out of the pit, Satan regained hegemony and the 1,000 years are over.
Right, right. And
other people can disagree with me,
sure.
but they're simply basing their beliefs on the false translations and the false manuscripts found in the King James Version of the Bible.
Right. Well, now, guest six, and I think guest six is speaking for many people because most people assume that when Satan was tossed into the pit for 1,000 years, that had to have been the work of the Holy Spirit or some good angel such as Michael the Archangel or Yahweh or Yahshua, right? That's what
it very well could have been the works of the Holy Spirit working through the early Christian church.
Right.
And it can be attributed to Constantine. It can be attributed to Constantinus II.
Right.
And especially to Theodosius II, the Byzantine emperor, who had passed all the laws against the Jews,
right.
which basically excluded the Jews from Christian society
right.
and forced them to go and cohabit among the Khazars and the Arabs and all the other races
right.
because they were excluded from Europe.
And
it outlawed banking.
Right.
It outlawed the Jews from the Jews from holding any public office.
Yes.
They outlawed the Jews from loaning any money and interest. They outlawed the Jews from holding Christian slaves. Basically, a series of laws that were all based on solid Christian principles and excluded the Jew from European society.
Yeah, and now when were the Jews actually chained up in the ghettos? When did the ghetto system start?
Well, this began around the 6th century, the 500 or so A.D.
Okay.
And they were kept in those ghettos until after the, with the dawn of the Enlightenment, that's the real corruption of the Catholic Church took place. I mean, there were a lot of so-called popes, right? Bishops
right.
of Rome that were screw-ups.
Right.
There's
oh, yeah.
no doubt.
Some of them were Jews, even.
yeah, yes. But uh-huh. in the 1400s, we got the Borgias.
Right.
And that's a crime ring. They were a Jewish crime ring that became
right.
popes. And then in the very beginning of the 16th century, the 1500s, we've got the De' Medicis. And they were a crime ring. That they were a family of Jewish bankers and former Jewish sorcerers, right? Medici medical,
yeah.
All right, doctors.
Right.
They were doctors who became bankers.
Okay.
And they supplied three popes at the beginning of the 1500s.
Bloodletting was a profitable enterprise, right?
Well, right. And when the De Medicis became popes, they changed the definition of usury to allow and basically legalize the loaning of interest in Christian Europe. And that's when Satan began to emerge from the pit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Satan, I believe, and I think that Sword Brother and I demonstrated this fully with the French Revolution, which allowed the Jews, the French Revolution let the Jews emerge from the ghettos.
Right.
And become full-fledged citizens.
That's right.
In Christian European society,
mm-hmm.
so that the Jews were citizens on an equal par, and it began in France, and Napoleon exported it to the rest of Europe.
Yes.
That is the total unleashing of Satan from the pit. And if you don't believe that, if you can't see that, you're just a fool. I'm sorry. From the French Revolution, the Jew has had full control over Christian the Christian Adamic world.
That's the little season. Well, after Satan was let loose from the pit, he has deceived the entire world for a little season.
Well, without doubt, anybody who doesn't think that it's the Jew, which is Satan, deceiving the world right now, they're just blind to everything going on in society.
That's right.
This is the fulfillment of this prophecy, and if you don't see it, you're blind.
Yeah, right. It's not the Catholic Church. It's not America. It's the Jew, right? Especially the international banking Jew. That's definitely the beast.
When Christ, when the second coming manifests itself and Christ emerges and all of his enemies are destroyed and Gog and Magog are thrown into the lake of fire and the Adamic race once again has hegemony on the earth,
mm-hmm.
how could we imagine that would only last 1,000 years
right.
when the scripture says that Christ will rule forever upon
right.
his return?
Yes.
How could we imagine that some future Gog and Magog would be able to
overcome him and his people?
That whole religion is ridiculous.
It's a false interpretation.
It's ridiculous. The entire Catholic religion is retarded.
Yes.
You have to be a fool to believe that the Catholic view of the end times, and it comes straight from the Jesuits, but it isn't based on anything that's actually truly scriptural.
Right.
It's an antichrist religion.
Yeah, right. So that in verse 5 where it says the 1,000 years appear to be apparently our future, that was added by a Catholic scribe.
By Antius of Caesarea, a Catholic scribe.
Okay.
And the church loved it because it helped them promote their futurism.
Right. Exactly. Very
Which
good.
Is why even though it appears in a minority of manuscripts on the Revelation, Koine Greek manuscripts on the Revelation,
uh-huh.
it became the one that was used in all of our Bibles.
Right. Okay. And then apparently the Anglican Church had no problem with it either.
Well,
okay.
Of course not.
Yes, because that's the King James Version. Right. Now, I just want to say one more thing with respect now to who put the beast into the pit for 1,000 years. And Yahweh will very often use another beast to discipline the current beast, right? And so it doesn't have to be a good force necessarily that locked Satan in 1,000 years. You know, I remember there was a movie, I think it was Rodan versus Godzilla, right? And everybody was trying to kill Godzilla, and so Rodan, I guess, did the job. So it was indeed the Catholic Church or people within the Catholic Church that eliminated the usurious banking monopoly that the Jews had, in the early days of Christianity. And I think it was Justinian. Justinian the First, who established the monastery system, and he threw out the court Jews from his court. He got sick and tired of their lip, and he just threw them out. Okay, so there were several instances where the Catholics did good things with respect to Jews. Right? That doesn't make the Catholic Church a good entity, but nevertheless, when you're trying to get rid of Godzilla, Rodan did the job. Okay, that's the point I'm trying to make. You have to understand that Yahweh uses even evil, you know, entities to destroy another evil entity. It's not always good versus evil. Sometimes it's evil versus evil that'll do the job in this case. Okay. So, any more, anything else on this subject?
Well, the Catholic Church did a lot of evil,
yes,
but it didn't do all evil.
Right.
And to see it as totally black, it is to have a religious view of history, right?
Yes.
And religion is probably not right. Yeah, you know, it's God is not religious in that sense. What we have to examine the facts. And the Catholic Church, while it did a lot of wrong, early on it did a lot of things right.
Mm-hmm.
There were good forces working inside of the Christian leadership of the time. It did not screw everything up.
Right.
And even though we know that the professional priesthood has absolutely no basis in New Testament scripture,
right,
there's no such thing as a Christian priest in the eyes of God. I'm sorry.
Yeah, not
we
a professional
are all
priesthood. Absolutely.
In the eyes of God. There
right.
should be no professional priesthood.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that those professional priests were an evil gang or an evil ring
right.
and did everything evil. It does. Most of them, for a long period of time, actually thought, were deceived themselves into thinking that they were doing good.
Right, right. Well, like Francis of Assisi, right?
And a lot of them did
mm-hmm.
things that were right. And
mm-hmm.
and
yes,
putting excoriating the Jews from society in the 6th century.
That was good.
Well, everybody, I don't know who would vote against that.
Right, right.
I don't know who would say that that was wrong.
Yes, yeah. Well, if Obama took out the United Nations building, that wouldn't be such a bad thing, right?
Well, right, but eventually the Jews won out in Europe,
yes.
and the Catholic Church, the Jews supported the Catholic Church in the 30 Years' War to probably kill 50 to 100 million Europeans.
Right.
And that was probably the evilest evil that the Church had ever done.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
but the you know, the Catholic Church did become corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
By the 14th century, 15th century, it was entirely corrupt. So in Rome, anyway, that there's no doubt. But
uh-huh.
but that doesn't mean that they were always corrupt all the time.
Right, right. And even if they were, it was still a good thing to put the Jews in the ghettos.
Yeah.
That was a good thing.
Well, right, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
We can't argue that. I don't know how
yeah.
anybody argued that was a bad thing.
Right, yeah. Sometimes bad people do good things. Okay? That's all we're trying to say. All right, very good. Okay, anything else before we get into Ezekiel 40?
Well, just like we saw that Revelation 18 and 19 were parallel with Ezekiel 38 and 39,
mm-hmm.
it'll become evident to all of those who have any common sense
that
Revelation 21 it is
yeah.
But Revelation 21 and the city descended from heaven and John's vision of that city
mm-hmm.
are very much parallel to Ezekiel's vision of this temple.
Yeah.
Except that this temple vision is very, very long and drawn out.
Right, right. Yes, and then since there is so much, and most of this is very figurative or symbolic or picturesque language, hard to interpret, I think what we're really talking about is, of course, the spiritual New Jerusalem seen by Ezekiel 2,500, how long ago are we talking about here? 3,000 years ago versus the Revelation, which was 2,000 years ago. Is that our
well,
time
well, right. Ezekiel's probably writing. He's writing this in 570 B.C.
Okay, so 2,500 years
and
ago.
He's writing this 660 years at least before the time John wrote the Revelation.
Yes, but I agree with you 100% that these later chapters of Ezekiel parallel the book of Revelation very strongly. All right, so let's continue here. Revelation chapter 40, verse 1. In the 25th year of our captivity, in the beginning of the year, in the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after that the city was smitten, in the self same day the hand of Yahweh was upon me and brought me here. Any comment on the time?
Well, I have some notes on the chronology.
Yeah.
That these prophecies of the temple from Ezekiel chapters 40 through the end of the book as we know it, through the end of chapter 48,
okay.
were all written at the same time around 572 B.C.
Okay.
Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 21, through the end of chapter 39. That entire pericope, almost seven chapters, right, was written in the 12th year of the captivity.
Okay.
That's where Jerusalem falls in the 10th month of that year, as is explained in Ezekiel 33.
Yeah.
That's 585 B.C. or thereabouts.
Okay.
Ezekiel chapter 40 here states that it was written in the 25th year of the captivity,
mm-hmm.
which is 572 B.C.
Mm-hmm.
However, it seems to intone 14 years after the fall of Jerusalem, and not 12 or 13. And that's, you know, difference in where we start counting a year and what month it is. And
right.
And this might be 571 B.C. That's not a problem.
Right.
Now, the Ezekiel 29:17 states that those verses which follow were written in the 27th year of the captivity.
Okay.
Now, that describes the actual fall of Tyre and Egypt. And if we were to order the chapters in Ezekiel properly, the pericope from 29:17 to 33:20, that would be the end of Ezekiel.
Conclusion, right.
But somehow the chapters are out of order. Those Jewish Masoretes were up to it again.
Yes.
And this temple vision is the end of Ezekiel.
Question, what about the Septuagint? Does that have
even though in the book of Jeremiah, the Septuagint has a very different chapter and verse order and probably almost assuredly the proper chapter and verse order,
yes,
as contrasted to the King James Version and the Masoretic text.
Mm-hmm.
The Masoretic text and the Septuagint agree on the order of chapters and verses where they're out of place in both Daniel and Ezekiel.
And
that just tells me that the confusion over the order of these chapters in Ezekiel was probably predated the making of the Septuagint.
Okay.
The Masoretes really can't be blamed for this, right?
Right, they can't.
They can be blamed for confusing Jeremiah, but not the chapter order of Daniel and Ezekiel, because it does match the Septuagint.
Okay. Now, it's quite possible that some scrolls or fragments of scrolls got jumbled up like a deck of cards, and that's why the confusion in the order, okay? But here we're definitely in the 25th year of the captivity, and he says 14 years after the fall of Jerusalem. If that was 586 B.C., then we are indeed in 572 B.C., okay? Which is, 572, 571. We can't be sure exactly from the date that Ezekiel himself is counting, but we're roughly around 572 B.C., correct?
Well, right, and even the ancients argued over chronology.
Yeah,
you know, all the mainstream chronologies I've seen are exactly 3 years off from everything Diodorus Siculus offers concerning Greek history, and that's something we should know better, right?
Right.
So it's very easy, these ancient chronologies, it's very easy to, where one nation used one method to count the reigns of kings and the years of their reigns, another nation used another method.
Right. Well, it's like the Egyptian king list. If you assume that the Egyptian chronology, then all the rest of them are wrong, right? If you assume the Greek chronology, all the others are wrong. So, but I think in general, the 586 B.C. date for the fall of Jerusalem is fairly sound archaeologically, right? I don't think we can go wrong there. And also 539 B.C., isn't that the fall of Babylon, aren't we, when the Babylonians were overthrown by the Medes and Persians?
Yes, it's not long after Ezekiel wrote.
Those dates are very firmly established in history, so I don't think we can really go wrong on those, okay? All right, so chapter 40, verse 2, in the visions of God brought he me into the land of Israel and set me upon a very high mountain by which was the frame of the city on the south. Now, of course, right here, this land of Israel would be figurative or symbolic or even spiritual, because he's being transported up and he's looking down upon the New Jerusalem from what I can perceive here, right? Wouldn't that be the case?
Well, right. And a little later on, we'll see that Ezekiel is still in the land of Kibar, and that's pretty far north of actual physical Israel.
Yeah, he's
far north of Mesopotamia.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's very clear that this is a vision of
what's
believed to be Israel, but the land of Israel, but not the Israel in Palestine.
Right. This is the land of Israel in the spirit that we're talking about here. Verse 3, and he brought me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of brass, with a line of flax in his hand, and a measuring reed, and he stood in the gate. He's a measuring guy, right? Verse 4, and the man said to me, Son of man, behold with your eyes and hear with your ears, and set your heart upon all that I shall show you now, for to the intent that I might show them to you are you brought here. Declare all that you see to the house of Israel, which, of course, means us right here today, okay, because very few Israelites of the ancient world had access to this information that we're talking about right now. And even the mainstream Judeo-Christian world, you know, which is populated mainly by true Israelites who don't know that they're Israelites, they haven't read this yet either. I mean, the document is available to our people, but very few of our people have ever really taken these books of Ezekiel or chapters of Ezekiel seriously. And, of course, when we're talking about all this figurative language here, very, very few analysts have any idea what this is all about. But first, before I ask you for a comment on the whole of verse 4 here, there was this expression, son of man, okay? Are we to take by this expression, son of Adam, man? Is that what he's...
Well, of course, okay. Yes. Wherever we see that phrase, it means a son of Adam. It's a very specific phrase.
Yes, because very often Yahshua is referred to as the son of man. Because
he actually called himself that.
Yes.
And I sincerely believe that he, being Yahweh come in the flesh,
yes,
called himself that as almost like a denigration of himself,
okay,
a stab at himself, you know, because being much higher than men,
mm-hmm,
he took upon himself, as Paul says in Greek anyway, he took upon himself the seed of Abraham.
Right.
In other words, he didn't have to be a man.
Right.
He's God. But
he had to be a man in order to be the sacrifice.
Well, right. But I mean, he had the free will to make his word long before, to get, you know, what to promise long,
yes,
before he promised it, right?
Yes.
So he only had to do it because he promised it, but yet he used that term of himself in a denigrating fashion, I believe.
Okay.
To call himself son of man.
Right, yeah, and I would just simply say that, you know, for me, it's son of man meaning that descendant of Adam, because Yahshua was a descendant of Adam, so was Ezekiel, so was Daniel, so was Jeremiah, so are we, okay? This is talking to us, son of man, okay? Verse 5, and behold, a wall on, oh, wait a minute, okay, declare all that you see to the house of Israel. I just want to reemphasize the fact that this is being declared to us today, right here, right now, true Israel, okay? Any more comments on verse 4 before I proceed?
No.
Okay. All right.
No. It's Ezekiel actually. He had contact with only one group of those of the Assyrian deportations, right?
Yes. Way up.
there were many groups that were spread all over the cities of the Medes and the land of Assyria in the north and Persia, and Ezekiel would have only been able to reach a small portion of them.
Right. Any idea which tribe that might have been? Does he specify?
Well, no. There's absolutely no indication at all what tribe it may have been.
Yeah. Okay. So,
but Ezekiel himself was of the house of Judah.
Right.
And we discussed early in the book of Ezekiel that Ezekiel was of the house of Judah, who were taken by the Babylonians and settled amongst the already deported Israelites who had been taken by the Assyrians.
Right. Right. Which adds further weight to our claim, which we've stated on many other shows, that a great number of Judahites and Benjamites from the house of Judah were added to the house of Israel in the north. And, of course, that captivity began around 745 B.C. The captivity of the house of those of the house of Judah was added after 700 B.C., but nevertheless, in the first deportations before the deportation to Babylon, right? Those were the Assyrian deportations. And many of the house of Judah, namely Judah and Benjamin, were added to the house of Israel. Thus, all 12 tribes were already taken captive during the Assyrian captivity, correct? Would that be?
Well, right. 46 fenced cities of Judah and Benjamin were taken by the Assyrians,
yes,
along with most of, yes, the Israelites, most of the people of the northern tribes.
Yes.
And all taken by the Assyrians. But Ezekiel is from a portion of the inhabitants of Jerusalem who were later taken, and in the days of, I believe it was Hezekiah, who were later taken when he was replaced on a throne by his brother.
Right.
And they were taken, where Ezekiel writes, in the 25th year of our captivity, 572 B.C., he was actually taken around 597 B.C.
Right, right.
He went into captivity with the king of Judah, who was replaced by his brother, I believe his name was Manasseh.
Mm-hmm.
That now, they were taken, they took 1,000 of the chief men of Jerusalem, I believe it was, and they settled them in amongst the Israelite captives who had been taken much earlier by the Assyrians.
Okay. Now, would that explain, at least in part, the fact that the Parthians, the empire later known as Parthia, had Judahite leaders among the house of Israel there? Okay. Would that be a contributing factor to the fact that the house of Israel had Judahites, namely the Pharez Judah, as their leaders until that nation of Parthia eventually fell apart?
Well, the word Parthia, it's very plausible. I can't say it's definite that the word Parthia can find its etymology, its root in the word Pharez.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
And the king of the Parthians always called themselves Arsaces, meaning the chief of the Saka.
Okay, Isaac.
Okay.
Chiefs of Isaac. Okay.
Well, that's the Saka was the Persian name for the Parthians and for all of the Scythians.
Right.
That were all derived from the Israelites of the deportations.
Mm-hmm. House of Isaac.
So it's not, I can't say it's a definite etymology,
right,
but it's a very plausible etymology for Parthian to have come, in Greek, Parthoi or Parthes to have come from the Hebrew word Pharez.
Yeah.
Which is actually Ferrets.
Yeah, and the reason I bring all that up is because the mainstream churches, and of course the Jews, are neglectful in explaining all this history and the deportations, because these deportations are absolutely critical in understanding the history of Europe and the scattering of the tribes of Israel into Europe, okay, becoming the various tribes becoming the nations of Europe. And that's why we call ourselves Anglo-Saxon Israel, okay? All right.
Well, I have a paper on my website, Classical Records of the Origins of the Scythians, Parthians, and Related Tribes, and it can be very well demonstrated from the pages of the historian Josephus that the Parthians are indeed the Israelites of the deportations.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Or among the Israelites of the deportations, I should say.
Right. Was it the obelisk? There was a three-language... I believe it was the Taylor Prism, which is three different languages, which identifies the Scythians and the Sakae with Israelites. Okay, so we have an actual archaeological find in three different languages that equates the Israelites, the Sakae, and what are the Cimmerians?
I know it equates the Saka and the Scythians and the Cimmerians.
Okay.
It doesn't quite go as far as to call them Israelites, however.
But one of them said that I, the king of Assyria, invaded the house of Beth Omri, which would be equivalent of Cimmerian. Okay.
Well, that's where the word Cimmeroi comes from. It
right.
comes from the Assyrian Humri or Cumri,
right.
as it's spelled in Western languages,
right.
and that is the house of Omri.
Right,
yes.
And that the king Omri. King Omri is exactly who's being identified there with that word, Cimmerian, really. Okay. All right. Now, verse 5. And behold, a wall on the outside of the house round about, and in the man's hand a measuring reed of 6 cubits long by the cubit and a hand breadth. So he measured the breadth of the building, 1 reed, and the height, 1 reed.
Now, this cubit here, I just want to describe it, that this is definitely describing the royal cubit.
Okay.
And that interpretation is upheld at 41:8, where Ezekiel refers to a reed of 6 great cubits.
Okay.
We had the standard cubit was about 18 inches.
Okay.
And the great cubit, or the royal cubit, it was called in Egypt, was about 21 inches,
okay,
which is a cubit and a span, right?
Right.
And therefore, this reed is 10 and a half feet long.
Okay.
And that's probably the only real detail I'm going to try to explain
right.
of all the measurements,
yes.
because it gets into very deep and very intricate detail. And I don't like myself to turn to Bullinger's number in Scripture, which really comes from the Kabbalah
mm.
and sources like that, to try to explain these numbers.
Right.
I'd rather admit that I really don't know what the numbers mean,
yes.
but perhaps one day they'll be better revealed to us.
Well, my understanding is a cubit was the distance from your elbow to the tip of your middle finger, okay? So that was originally 18 or 16 inches or something like that. And then the royal cubit is that cubit plus a span. What's a span now? The width of the
hand?
Well,
a span would be the width of your hand, yes.
Okay. So you add that. So you get a royal cubit is roughly 21 inches, and a regular cubit is what, roughly 18 inches? Something
yes.
like that. Okay. That's what these measurements are based on. Okay. All right. Verse 6. Then came he to the gate which looks toward the east, and went up the stairs thereof, and measured the threshold of the gate, which was one reed broad. So how long is this threshold?
10.5 feet.
10.5 feet. And the other threshold of the gate, which was also one reed broad. And every little chamber was one reed long and one reed broad, and between the little chambers were 5 cubits, and the threshold of the gate by the porch of the gate inside was one reed. He measured also the porch of the gate inside one reed. Then measured he the porch of the gate 8 cubits, and the post thereof 2 cubits, and the porch of the gate was inward. And the little chambers of the gate eastward were 3 on this side and 3 on that side, and they were of one measure, and the post had one measure on this side and that side. And he measured the breadth of the entry of the gate 10 cubits, and the length of the gate 13 cubits. The space also before the little chambers was 1 cubit on this side, and the space was 1 cubit on that side. And the little chambers were 6 cubits on this side and 6 cubits on that side.
Concerning verse 10, you know, all I could say is that in Revelation 20, where John talks about the city descended from heaven, it has three gates
uh-huh.
on each side,
okay.
one for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. That
right.
would be 12 gates, right?
Right.
And here we have one gate with what looks like 3 chambers on each
mm-hmm.
side. So it's similar. It's not exact, but it's very
right.
similar to the language in Revelation.
Right. So whatever spiritual vision he's being given here does have similarities to the vision given to John 600 years later, okay? Verse 13, he measured then the gate from the roof of the one little chamber to the roof of another, and the breadth was 5 and 20 cubits, door against door. He made also posts of 3 score cubits, even unto the post of the court round about the gate. And from the face of the gate of the entrance to the face of the porch of the inner gate were 50 cubits. And there were narrow windows to the little chambers and to their posts within the gate round about, and likewise to the arches, and the windows were round about inward, and upon each post were palm trees. Well, it sounds like we're just talking about the divisions of the various councils. You know, of course, you have your 24 elders, you have the 12 patriarchs and the 12 apostles, and it sounds like all of these chambers are places for these various elders to gather. Verse 17, then brought he me to the outward court, and lo, there were chambers and a pavement made for the court round about. 30 chambers were upon the pavement. And the pavement by the side of the gates opposite the length of the gates was the lower pavement. Then he measured the breadth from the forefront of the lower gate to the forefront of the inner court outside, 100 cubits eastward and northward. And the gate of the outward court that looked toward the north, he measured the length thereof and the breadth thereof. And the little chambers thereof were 3 on this side and 3 on that side. And the posts thereof and the arches thereof were after the measure of the first gate, and the length thereof was 50 cubits, and the breadth 5 and 20 cubits. And their windows and their arches and their palm trees were after the measure of the gate that looks toward the east, and they went up to it by 7 steps, and the arches thereof were before them. And the gate of the inner court was opposite the gate toward the north and toward the east, and it measured from gate to gate 100 cubits. After that he brought me toward the south, and behold, a gate toward the south, and he measured the posts thereof and the arches thereof according to these measures. and there were windows in it, and the arches thereof round about like those windows. The length was 50 cubits, and the breadth 25 cubits, and there were 7 steps to go up to it, and the arches thereof were before them. And it had palm trees, one on this side and another on that side upon the post thereof. And there was a gate in the inner court toward the south, and he measured from gate to gate toward the south 100 cubits. And he brought me to the inner court by the south gate, and he measured the south gate according to these measures, and the little chambers thereof, and the posts thereof, and the arches thereof according to these measures. And there were windows in it, and in the arches thereof round about it was 50 cubits long and 25 cubits broad. And the arches round about were 25 cubits long and 25 cubits broad. And the arches thereof were toward the utter court. That's U-T-T-E-R, not outer.
Well, it's the far court, right?
Far court, okay. And the palm trees were upon the post thereof and going. So it's not, we're talking about the four sides, all very similar. And he brought me into the inner court toward the east, and he measured the gate according to these measures, and the little chambers thereof and the posts thereof. And the arches thereof were according to these measures, and there were windows therein, and the arches thereof round about, it was 50 cubits long and 25 cubits broad. And the arches thereof were toward the outward court, and the palm trees were upon the post thereof on this side and on that side, and the going up to it had 8 steps. Okay, all the others had 7, but this one has 8. And he brought me to the north gate and measured it according to these measures, the little chambers thereof, the post thereof, and the arches thereof, etc., etc., 50 cubits, 25 cubits, and the posts thereof were toward the outer court, and the palm trees on both sides, and the chambers and entries thereof were by the posts of the gates, and they were washed by the burnt offering. And in the porch of the gate were 2 tables on this side and 2 tables on that side to slay thereon the burnt offering and the sin offering and the trespass offering. Now, as I'm reading this and thinking about all this, it sounds to me like what Ezekiel is describing is the temple in heaven corresponding to the actual physical offering of sacrifices going on here on earth by the Levitical priesthood. That's just what's occurring to me as I'm reading this right now. What's your sense so far of this?
Well, that would be the best literal interpretation of it, mm-hmm. because that's what he's seeing is a temple in heaven.
Right.
And I think that this is all allegorical for mm-hmm. the service which the people of the city of God shall do for God
right.
and in the future.
Okay.
However, I don't take the sacrifices to be literal.
Right. Yeah.
There's no need for such sacrifices in the future.
Right, right. But certainly in the days that those sacrifices were being offered, there was a figurative or slash spiritual house of sacrifice in heaven because the earth mirrors the heavens, and there had to be a spiritual acceptance of all of the physical sacrifices that were going on the planet. So if we put it in the past, it would fit that, and certainly I agree, and the correspondences to the book of Revelation concerning the New Jerusalem are indeed future. So all of this can be projected into the future as well. Verse 40, and at the side outside as one goes up to the entry of the north gate were 2 tables, and on the other side, which was the porch of the gate, were 2 tables. 4 tables on this side and 4 tables on that side by the side of the gate, 8 tables whereupon they slew their sacrifices, and the 4 tables were of hewn stone for the burnt offering of 1.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits broad and 1 cubit high, whereupon also they laid the instruments wherewith they slew the burnt offering and the sacrifice. And inside were hooks and a hand broad fastened round about, and upon the tables was the flesh of the offering, and outside the inner gate were the chambers of the singers in the inner court, which was at the side of the north gate, and their prospect was toward the south, one at the side of the east gate having a prospect toward the north. And he said to me, this chamber whose prospect is toward the south is for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the house, and the chamber whose prospect is toward the north is for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the altar. These are the sons of Zadok among the sons of Levi, which were come near to Yahweh to minister to him. So in verse 46, we have mention of the priests or the sons of Zadok, which is mentioned quite a lot in the book of Hebrews. Let me just jump into Hebrews here. I think it was chapter 7 of the book of Hebrews where Paul gets into the priesthood of the order of Melchizedek. And as I understand it, the priesthood of the order of Melchizedek is simply the hereditary lineage of Israel, going all
well,
the way back.
Well, Zadok literally means righteous.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. The kings of righteousness, I think, is or priests of righteousness, I think, is what Melchizedek literally stands for. And but here, chapter 7, book of Hebrews, verse 1. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being by interpretation king of righteousness, and after that also king of Salem, which is king of peace, without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like to the Son of God, abides a priest continually. Now, it seems to me that we're talking about the hereditary priesthood that comes from Adam and continues in us today. We, Adamites, are expected to be priests when we turn 30 years of age, especially if we have a household. If we're head of household, then we are expected to be a king and a priest of that household. That's how I interpret this priesthood of the order of Melchizedek. But there's a problem here with this one verse, without the verse 3. Without father, without mother, without descent. I can see this if we're talking about a priesthood, a hereditary priesthood that is, how should I put this, separated from the particular father and mother that they have at the time. In other words, the priesthood has a lineage of its own. Okay. Now, I know Clifton had made a study of this, that Adam would be the first priest, and then next would be Seth, and then who was it? Methuselah would be third. But Noah was not one of these priests, was he?
No.
Okay.
No, he
didn't live long enough to
Well, Lamech wasn't one of those priests, and neither was Enoch.
Okay.
They were both skipped over because Methuselah, Noah's grandfather, outlived Lamech, Noah's father.
Okay.
So it would have passed from Methuselah to Noah.
Okay.
Okay. Now, before the time of Methuselah was Enoch, and Enoch was taken by Yahweh.
Right.
But I think his father was Jared, right? I mean, I might be wrong.
Okay.
But it would have passed from Enoch's father to Enoch's son, who was Methuselah.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. So it skipped two people that the leading patriarch of the Adamic race,
yes,
skipped over Enoch, and it skipped over Lamech of all the patriarchs. That's why Enoch is considered seventh from Adam, but Noah is considered the eighth preacher of righteousness by Peter.
Okay, okay. So one is reckoning the descent of the high priest, and the other is reckoning the descent of the actual patriarchs.
Yes.
Okay.
And it would have, Abel is counted in the statement that Enoch was seventh from Adam.
Mm-hmm.
We have to count either Abel or Cain, right?
Okay. Oh, I see.
To count Abel. We're forced to count Abel. In other words, that statement proves that Cain is excluded entirely.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
But it's counting that the oldest firstborn sons,
uh-huh,
okay?
Right.
It has to be because Seth is a replacement for Abel,
right,
and that statement, Enoch is seventh from Adam, has to include both Abel and Seth,
okay,
to make it so.
All right, so Abel would have been high priest while he was alive, and of course Cain...
This Peter's statement that Noah was the eighth preacher of righteousness,
uh-huh,
can't include Abel.
Okay. All right,
okay,
so
and Abel never
Adam
held it because he died before his father.
Ah, okay.
But Seth held it because he outlived his father.
All right, right. Okay, so it goes Adam to Seth, and then Noah. Was he ever high priest, or what did he have?
Oh yes, he was the eldest patriarch.
Okay.
He was the eldest. Yeah, you know, of the family of the eldest line.
Okay. So we're talking about two different lineages here, one of the high priests, one of the patriarchs, which they're not the same, okay? And now, would that be an explanation here of this discrepancy in verse 3, without father, without mother, without descent? Is that a
question? Well, you know, I think that Paul is there making an allegory.
Okay.
He's making an allegory based on the fact that the Melchizedek mentioned in the Old Testament in Genesis, I believe it's chapter 12 perhaps, or 13, that the Melchizedek mentioned in that account with Abraham, nothing spoken of before him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know what? We don't
right.
know who he is
okay.
simply from the account in the book of Genesis.
Without
we
have known descent. In other words, this could be interpreted as being...
It can be interpreted
known.
As being without recorded descent.
Without recorded yeah. descent. Okay, all right. Because if we take this literally, without descent, well, that can't be true. You know.
But, well, no, he would. There's only one without descent. That
yeah.
would have to be Yahweh sitting there.
Right.
Now,
exactly.
A lot of people insist because of that, that is Yahweh sitting there, or that is Christ.
Okay, I see what you mean.
But that interpretation can be argued against very effectively,
right.
and I find it a highly dubious interpretation.
Right. Now, what is the actual language there in the Greek? Does it say without descent or without recorded descent?
Well, it says without genealogy is the word genealogia.
Okay,
but that
right.
is recording of a descent.
Right,
I mean,
yeah, so genealogy would be a better translation.
But it also says without father and without mother, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that Paul is using a literary device,
yes.
taking advantage of the fact that we're not told who
right.
Melchizedek
okay.
is.
We don't know who
they
are.
Account with Abraham.
Yeah, okay. So we can't take this verse literally. So, and I think that's proper. Let me continue here, verse 4. Now, consider how great this man was to whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of the spoils. Now, was this Nahor his older brother at this time? Have any idea who the high priest of the order of Melchizedek was at this time?
Well, at Abraham's time, I believe it was Abraham's older brother.
Okay, was that Nahor?
Nahor or Terah. I'm sorry, I always get it.
Well, Terah was his father, but his father was an idolater. So it couldn't have been Terah. So probably Nahor. Okay. And verse 5, and verily they that are of the sons of Levi who receive the office of the priesthood have a commandment to take tithes of the people according to the law, that is, of their brethren, though they come out of the loins, that they also come out of the loins of Abraham. So this priesthood of the order of Melchizedek existed before Abraham, and continues after the priesthood of the Levites. That's what Paul is telling us here. And, of course, we Israelites are that priesthood. Okay? Where was I? Oh, yeah. Okay, getting back to Ezekiel. Let me repeat. This is chapter 40, verse 46. Let me repeat verse 46. And the chamber whose prospect is toward the north is for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the altar. These are the sons of Zadok, among the sons of Levi, which come near to Yahweh to minister to him. So we have these two distinct priesthoods being mentioned. We have to know the difference between these two priesthoods. They're not the same.
Well, we also have to say that, you know, there was a Zadok who was a Levite.
Okay, yes. Yes.
All right, in the scripture, there was a Zadok. And even though it does mean righteousness and it is connected to the meaning of Melchizedek, which is king of righteousness, there's a Zadok in the scripture. And he was a pretty prominent priest at the time of David.
Okay.
Now, if Christ is the second David, that's why we see Zadok mentioned here.
Uh-huh. Okay.
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 Zadok was not only the priest who brought, along with Abiathar, finally brought the covenant, the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem for the
uh-huh.
final time, right? He did that, but he was also, along with Nathan the prophet, the priest who anointed Solomon king at the death of David.
Okay. So this is a very important priest. He presided over very significant events. Very good. Verse 47, so he measured the court 100 cubits long and 100 cubits broad, 4 square, and the altar that was before the house, and he brought me to the porch of the house and measured each post of the porch 5 cubits on this side, 5 cubits on that side, and the breadth of the gate was 3 cubits on this side and 3 cubits on that side. The length of the porch was 20 cubits and the breadth 11 cubits, and he brought me by the steps whereby they went up to it, and there were pillars by the posts, one on this side and another on that side. Okay, a lot of figurative language here, but a couple of really interesting verses that have some historical content. All right, chapter 41, verse 1. Afterward, he brought me to the temple and measured the posts, 6 cubits broad on the one side, and 6 cubits broad on the other side, which was the breadth of the tabernacle. And the breadth of the door was 10 cubits, and the sides of the door were 5 cubits on the one side and 5 cubits on the other. And he measured the length thereof 40 cubits, and the breadth 20 cubits. And then he went inward and measured the post of the door, 2 cubits, and the door 6 cubits, and the breadth of the door 7 cubits. So he measured the length thereof 20 cubits and the breadth 20 cubits before the temple. And he said to me, "This is the most holy place." After he measured the wall of the house 6 cubits and the breadth of every side chamber, 4 cubits round about the house on every side. And the side chambers were 3, one over another, and 30 in order. And they entered into the wall which was of the house for the side chambers round about, that they might have hold, but they had not hold in the wall of the house. Again, you know, my comment would be, well, we're looking at a spiritual tabernacle or a spiritual temple, and it's corresponding to the physical temple on the earth. Verse 7, and there was an enlarging and a winding about still upward to the side chambers, for the winding about of the house went still upward round about the house. Therefore, the breadth of the house was still upward, and so increased from the lowest chamber to the highest by the midst. I saw also the height of the house round about. The foundation of the side chambers were a full reed of 6 great cubits. What's the difference again between the great?
Well, that would be the 21-inch, the 21-inch cubit, right? The royal cubit
plus the span, which would be the width of a hand. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Well, so from 18 to 21, roughly. The thickness of the wall, which was for the side chamber without, was 5 cubits, and that which was left was the place of the side chambers that were inside, and between the chambers was the wideness of 20 cubits round about the house on every side. I bet the King James translators had fun with this chapter.
Oh, yes, I'm sure. And let me say this, concerning the 2 cubits, the 2 cubits, 2 different cubit measurements, what was implemented also in ancient Egypt, right? And it was spoken about in secular Greek writings.
Yes.
I don't remember the exact citation. I think it was Herodotus. I could be wrong. But there was a mention in secular Greek writings of the standard and royal cubits. That there was a larger cubit and a smaller one.
Right, right. Yeah. So this
and the Greeks also used the that they didn't call it cubit, but they had a term which was equivalent to cubit.
Right. Yeah, and it probably varied from one nation to another. Yeah. Okay. And the doors of the side chambers were toward the place that was left, one door toward the north and another toward the south. And the breadth of the place that was left was 5 cubits round about. And, of course, this is kind of dull reading, folks, but we're going through this to see if we find gems, gems within the haystack here. Verse 12.
It's a pacus is a Greek word that is the same measurement as a cubit.
Okay.
And it's a very old word.
What's that?
It's a very old word. It
very
clearly came from the Hebrew chest.
Okay. Now, yeah, and then I think a lot of Greek words actually have their foundation in Hebrew, so it'd be interesting, you know, to do the word derivations of some of these measuring units, right? Verse 12, now the building that was before the separate place at the end toward the west was 70 cubits broad, and the wall of the building was 5 cubits thick round about, and the length of thereof 90 cubits. So he measured the house 100 cubits long, and the separate place and the building with the walls thereof 100 cubits. So it sounds like we're describing the halls of government, and if this can be projected into the future, which I believe it is intended to be, the New Jerusalem has these halls of government, whether, you know, taken spiritually or metaphorically.
Well, when we get to 43, we'll definitely see that this intends the future.
Okay, very good.
But without a doubt.
Okay. Verse 14, also the breadth of the face of the house and the separate place toward the east, 100 cubits. And he measured the length of the building opposite the separate place, which was behind it, and the galleries thereof on one side and On the other side, 100 cubits, with the inner temple and the porches of the court, the doorposts and the narrow windows and the galleries round about on their three stories, opposite the door sealed or paneled with wood round about, and from the ground up to the windows, and the windows were covered. To that above the door, even to the inner house and the outside, and by all the wall round about inside and outside by measure. And it was made with the cherubims and the palm trees, so that a palm tree was between the cherub and a cherub, and every cherub had two faces. And what are we to make of these cherubs? Because these are...
Well, archaeology pretty much proves that the cherub was what we would consider to be a winged sphinx. It was a winged sphinx. It was sort of like a sphinx, and I believe it's definitely of the same origin as the sphinx.
Okay.
The sphinx isn't complete, in that the great sphinx in Egypt, for instance, is only the head of a man and the body of a lion, right?
Right. No wings.
But the original cherub of the Assyrians, and these are actually called cherubs.
Right.
And I believe this is also applicable to the same cherubs of the Hebrews,
uh-huh,
were the Assyrians forgot the lion part, right?
Yeah.
They had the body of a bull usually by itself, the head of a man, and the wings of an eagle.
Right.
But in the Hebrews, and even though in places everywhere where the Phoenicians went, we find variations on the cherub feature, right?
Right.
And in Spain, we have cherubs with wings, without wings. Cherubs were found in Greece, in Italy, along the coast of northern Africa, little cherub statues. There's about five or six good examples of pictures of cherubs on Christogenia, I believe in the Israelite Greek section,
uh-huh,
right? Or possibly in the Phoenician section. I think in identifying the Phoenicians, my paper on classical records and classical and biblical records and identifying the Phoenicians, I have five or six pictures of cherub statuettes that were found that date some of them to the 5th and 6th centuries B.C. They were found wherever the Phoenicians went.
Okay.
They were Israelites. They were found in Spain. They were found in Greece. They were found in Italy.
Right, right.
Now they were the body part was variegated. Sometimes it was just a lion, but properly the cherub had the fore part of a lion and the hind part of a bull.
Okay.
The wings of an eagle and the head of a man.
Right.
That's a proper cherub, and they are the symbols of the four standards about the tabernacle in the wilderness.
Right, and it's the four.
Judah, Ephraim,
four
Dan.
Tribes. Go ahead.
And Reuben.
Yeah.
Judah, Ephraim, Dan, and Reuben.
Right. The man is Reuben, the bull is Ephraim, the lion is Judah, and the eagle is Dan.
Yes, and Ephraim is the ass, so we should remind that Russell Walker.
Okay, very good. The hindmost parts, right? Very good. All right, verse 19. So that the face of a man was toward the palm tree on the one side, and the face of a young lion toward the palm tree on the other side. It was made through all the house round about. So we definitely have symbols of the four main tribes of Israel. That's what the cherubs consist of. Verse 20, from the ground to above the door were cherubims and palm trees made, and on the wall of the temple. The posts of the temple were squared, and the face of the sanctuary, the appearance of the one as the appearance of the other. The altar of wood was 3 cubits high, and the length thereof 2 cubits, and the corners thereof, and the length thereof, and the walls thereof were of wood. And he said to me, this is the table that is before Yahweh. And the temple and the sanctuary had 2 doors, and the doors had 2 leaves apiece, 2 turning leaves, 2 leaves for the one door, and 2 leaves for the other door. And there were made on them, on the doors of the temple, cherubims and palm trees, like as were made upon the walls, and there were thick planks upon the face of the porch outside. And there were narrow windows and palm trees on the one side and on the other side, on the sides of the porch, and upon the side chambers of the house, and thick planks. Okay, that takes us to the end of chapter 41. Let's continue now, chapter 42. Then he brought me forth into the outer court, the way toward the north, and he brought me into the chamber that was opposite the separate place, and which was before the building toward the north. Before, the length of 100 cubits was the north door, and the breadth was 50 cubits, opposite the 20 cubits, which were for the inner court, and opposite the pavement, which was for the outer court, was gallery against gallery in three stories. And before the chambers was a walk of 10 cubits breadth inward, away of 1 cubit, and their doors toward the north. Now the upper chambers were shorter, for the galleries were higher than these, than the lower, and then the middlemost of the building, for they were in three stories, but had not pillars as the pillars of the courts. Therefore the building was straightened more than the lowest and the middlemost from the ground, which I'm not sure what that was supposed to mean. Oh, they were set back, I guess. So, if you have doorways on three stories, you want to set them back so that you have walkways to approach each doorway. Verse 7, and the wall that was outside opposite the chambers toward the outer court on the fore part of the chambers, the length thereof was 50 cubits, for the length of the chambers that were in the outer court was 50 cubits, and lo, before the temple were 100 cubits. And from under these chambers was the entry on the east side as one goes into them from the outer court. If we have a really good painter, he could work on a painting for us to help us visualize all this. But of course, this is all metaphorical and spiritual in intent, and therefore I think we're discussing here the various meeting rooms of the government of true Israel after the judgment day, when the new Jerusalem, and you know, that is the heavenly Jerusalem and the earthly Jerusalem, merge together. Verse 10, the chambers were in the thickness of the wall of the court toward the east, opposite to the separate place and the opposite building. And the way there before them was like the appearance of the chambers which were toward the north, as long as they and as broad as they, and all their goings out were both according to their fashions and according to their doors. There's a lot of activity going on here. And according to the doors of the chambers that were toward the south was a door in the head of the way, even the way directly before the wall toward the east, as one enters into them. Then said he to me, the north chambers and the south chambers, which are before the separate place, they be holy chambers, where the priests that approach to Yahweh shall eat the most holy things. There shall they lay the most holy things, and the meat offering, and the sin offering, and the trespass offering, for the place is holy. When the priests enter therein, then shall they not go out of the holy place into the outer court, but there they shall lay their garments wherein they minister, for they are holy, and shall put on other garments, and shall approach to those things which are for the people. Again, this is mirroring the activity of the Levitical priests here on earth. Now when he had made an end of measuring the inner house, he brought me forth toward the gate, whose prospect is toward the east, and measured it round about. He measured the east side with the measuring reed, 500 reeds with the measuring reed round about. He measured the north side, south side, west side, and he measured it by the four sides. Jumping to verse 20, it had a wall round about, 500 reeds long and 500 broad, to make a separation between the sanctuary and the profane place or common place where the people gather. So, again, there will always be a separation here between the priests, the offerings the priests make, and the people gathered round about. Okay, chapter 43, verse 1.
Well, I'd just like to say that you know, I'm going to reiterate part of what I said before, is that I don't believe, well, first, all these measurements mean something.
Right.
I'm not going to be vain enough to pretend that I know what they mean.
Right.
I just simply don't. And this service to Yahweh, to God, and the idea of these sacrifices, I believe that chapter 43 will prove that this is talking about the future, and chapter 44. However, I believe that the sacrifices and the services that parallel the Levitical sacrifices and services, which Ezekiel's talking about, that, you know, the prophet is seeing a vision and relating it, and he's seeing it on terms that he can understand.
Sure.
And the Greek word liturgeo is the word from which we get liturgy from,
mm-hmm.
right? And that means a service to, in ancient Athens, a service to the community, a service that you performed for the community as a free man was a liturgy,
mm-hmm.
Okay, a liturgus. Now the Ezekiel is expressing on his own terms that this is simply a city or a temple that would be the chief seat of the service of our race to God. And, and that's the way I see this. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we will be literally making sacrifices, right?
Yes, it won't be literal sacrifices. But yeah, let me jump to Hebrews chapter 13, where I think Paul has a commentary that pertains to this. I'm going to read chapter 13, verses 12 through 17 here. Wherefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Let us go forth, therefore, to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. So we have to bear his reproach. For here we have no continuing city that is on this earth, but we seek one to come. Okay? What's that? It's the New Jerusalem. Verse 15. By him, therefore, let us offer the sacrifice of praise to God continually, that is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name. So he's referring to this as a sacrifice. You know, we take time out of our day to praise Yahweh and pray to Yahweh, verse 16, but to do good and to communicate, forget not, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. Again, Paul tells us we should do good. That is the sacrifice. That is the replacement for the Levitical sacrifices. Verse 17, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls. Of course, we're talking about legitimate authorities. We're not talking about tyrannical Jews. As they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable to you. Now, of course, we all have to pay this sacrifice, this tithe of living under, you know, obviously this world is run by the Antichrist, by the prince of this world, and as long as it is, we only have, there's only a limited thing, amount that we can accomplish, but nevertheless, we are to tarry till he comes. We're supposed to obey the law, love one another, do good, and perform those sacrifices, which Paul is talking about as, you know, our daily sacrifices for each other, right? Isn't that what Paul is telling us here?
Absolutely. That is the new sacrifice. And that's, you know, Christ said several times in the Gospel, quoting the Old Testament, it's mercy I seek and not sacrifice.
Right.
But the ancient Levites had learned to sell mercy for favors, right? Or to use sacrifices for bribes, and they made a business out of it. Sounds like Catholics, huh?
Right.
Well, mercy was what was scarcely to be found in the ancient kingdom because sacrifices and absolution had become a business, just like the medieval Catholic Church.
Right.
Absolution had become a business, and that's odious to God.
Right.
And it's love to your brother, which comes even, and it's, well, before the law.
Yes.
It first comes love for your brother. If you don't love your brother and have mercy and treat your brother with mercy and forgiveness, then you can't claim to honor God above all.
Right.
You can't make that claim because he wants us to love our brethren.
That's right. Yeah, so good works become the new sacrifices under the new jurisdiction, that is the New Jerusalem. So, again, the Judeo Christians have this totally wrong. They actually believe that Paul is saying good works are not necessary for your salvation. They're absolutely necessary for the coming in of the kingdom. If we're not doing good works, we don't deserve the kingdom. That's the bottom line, folks. Okay? And let me just continue because I think there's really no point in starting in on chapter 43, because we only have about 5 minutes left of the show, but let me just continue reading here in Hebrews chapter 13. Let me repeat verse 17 again, because let me get your take on this. Obey them that have rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. And many critics of Paul say, well, we should bear our slavery at the hands of the Zionist superstate without without complaint. Is that what this verse means?
Well, then you could also criticize Peter, who said, subject yourself to every ordinance and authority of man.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's the meaning here? What are we supposed
to
do?
Well, Paul's teaching is that if we do good, even evil rulers will have no cause to harm us.
Right. Okay.
And if we seek to do good, how could we be judged as evil? How could we be judged for bad?
So when we're doing
bad, you know, most of the people that really complain, I'm not saying the government is good by any means.
Right.
The Zionist government is an absolute tyranny that we live under today.
Okay.
But if you have good works and do constant good and strive to help your kindred, your race, your brother, what can the Jew say about you?
Right. What can he do to you? I think this invokes, as many times throughout the Old Testament, that if we obey the law, Yahweh protects us. So I think what this verse is telling us, that the best way to fight this evil world is for us Israelites to do good works among ourselves and work for the kingdom, rather than trying to fight the devil fisticuff-wise, you know, back and forth, where he always wins, doesn't he?
I have seen all of my adult life, I've observed that the people that claim to hate the government the most, right,
uh-huh.
that are constantly fighting the government in the courts, with the UCC, the tax protesters, and all of that, they're really only seeking after their own belly.
So
they're not seeking the thing to help their brethren.
Right.
They're not trying to help their race. And they're really only trying to beat the government so they could get over and fill their own bellies. It all comes down to materialism and the desire to become rich, to enrich yourself outside of the government purview, which is what they really want.
Right.
They're not trying to help themselves at all, to help their race at all.
Right. It's self-righteousness, really. Obviously, they perceive themselves as trying to do good, and actually, in their own eyes, they are doing good by fighting an evil government. But aren't we correct in saying that they're going about it in the wrong way? Because it's
right, because I've seen those people dedicate their whole lives to fighting the government,
right.
and they don't have 1 minute to spend on their brother.
Right. And they waste all their money, right, and money they don't even have, trying to fight an evil government when we should be creating a kingdom among ourselves with brotherly love, okay? And then all the money...
And not worrying about the government.
Right.
And not caring what they might do to us tomorrow.
Because if we do that, if we together build a kingdom, Yahweh protects us and they can't do anything to us.
Well, that's the promise, is to seek the kingdom first.
Yes.
And all those other things will be added.
Yes, yeah, and that even pertains to actual warfare with the evil beings of this planet. We are to respond to them, not by, you know, fighting back directly, even if they, you know, attack us personally. Our main job is to build a kingdom of brotherly love amongst our own brethren. That's what we're supposed to do. So let me continue here. Verse 18, pray for us. For we trust we have a good conscience in all things, willing to live honestly. But I beseech you the rather to do this, that I may be restored to you the sooner. Now the God of peace said, okay, he's just concluding. Verse 21. Well, here, let me read this because this is good. Now the God of peace that brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus, that great shepherd of the sheep, through the blood of the everlasting covenant. Okay. Now this everlasting covenant. Is this any different from the covenant that Yahweh gave to his people Israel at Mount Sinai? Is there any real difference here?
There's no real difference.
Yes, that's the everlasting covenant. There was a note, in fact, Jeremiah 31 says, well, the new covenant will be everlasting, right? And that consists of the law being written in our hearts, verse 21. Make you perfect in every good work to do his
May he
will.
Restore you in all good. May he restore you in all good.
Restore you. Okay.
Yes. We're restored to Yahweh, to the position we had as ancient Israelites.
Yes.
As his people in the earth.
Right.
We are restored to him under the new covenant.
Okay. And that restoration, it consists in every good work. Okay? I don't know how these people can say that Paul doesn't teach good works. It's amazing, right? Working in you that which is well-pleasing in his sight through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen. Verse 23, know you that our brother Timothy is set at liberty, apparently meaning that Timothy was set free at this time. Salute them, all that have the rule over you, and all the saints, they of Italy salute you. Grace be with you all. Now, of course, here to Hebrews, who was he addressing here? And who was ruling over the Hebrews at this time?
Well, this was Paul's letter to the circumcision of the East.
Okay.
And that's who he's addressing. And he's also informing them, basically, that Timothy was imprisoned with him in Rome for a while, and Timothy was released.
Uh-huh.
And Paul also mentions that in certain other of his epistles.
Right, right. Now, is this during the time of the persecutions under Nero, or was that yet to come? Because certainly Paul wouldn't be teaching people to obey Nero. You know, I mean, there was all-out war between the Christians and Nero.
Well, those that bear the rule over he's writing Hebrews and telling them to respect their local rulers.
Okay.
You know, the empire is a very the government of the empire is a large and complex thing. Yeah, you know, Obama's our president,
right,
but he doesn't rule over us day to day. Yeah, you know, respect your rulers doesn't necessarily mean respect that beast in the White House.
Yeah, and many of those are actually kinsmen very often of the Israelites, although they don't know it.
Well, right. We have local leaders, political leaders, chiefs of police, mayors, are our real
And we should be on good terms with those people. We should.
Yes.
Yes.
There's no reason to despise those people.
Right.
Even though the extremists, and I mean the real extremists, would say, oh, they're all bad because they're working for Zog.
Right.
Anybody with any Christian common sense would understand and be forgiving that these people don't know the difference between the good government that we need and the evil Zionist forces operating within our government to pervert it and use it to their own ends.
Yes.
We need good government.
Right.
We understand and recognize the evil Zionist forces. Most people in good government are oblivious to that.
Uh-huh.
They have no idea.
That's right.
It takes a lot of waking up. And I worked in government. I understand it firsthand. You don't. You think you're doing good for your community, working for the Zionists. You think you're doing the right thing, and you're not. But what's it going to take to wake each individual up to the fact that they're not? It's a different story.
They
are, however, for the most part, our kin and our brethren, and we're told over and over again in Scripture that we should be understanding and forgiving of that.
Right.
That's just the way it is. That's the Scripture.
So Billy,
you would think that I'm pro-government. Well, that's a lie.
Right.
That's just, you're misrepresenting everything I just said.
Well, you enjoy going to prison for, right?
Well, right.
If that's what you mean.
I mean, I've been there. If they want to, if they want to do what they say, then they should follow me.
Right.
They should go there.
Yes.
And see what it's like.
Yeah, see what it's like. So Paul is exhorting the Israelites here to, as I said, in many cases, their leaders here are actually fellow Israelites, but they happen to be working for Rome, okay? Doesn't make them evil men, okay? But it's a huge bureaucratic government. And if we bring this up to our personal circumstances, we should always be on good terms with our fellow citizens who happen to be police officers, tax collectors, et cetera, et cetera. Wasn't one of the apostles a tax collector?
Give to Caesar what is Caesar's.
Right.
One of the apostles was Matthew, and he was a tax collector.
Right.
And give to Caesar what is Caesar's.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you do that and you give to Yahweh what is Yahweh's, you won't have need of the things you think you have need of.
Right, right.
And we shouldn't be economically oriented people. And all of the people that really hate the government the most and despise their own kinsmen in government, you'll find that they're usually economically oriented people, and they're really just jealous of the quote unquote insiders who were the haves, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and then they might have, you know, a righteous cause in that they see that the IRS, for example, is a huge evil bureaucracy, and the income tax amendment was never properly ratified, right? And all those things are true. But nevertheless, if you take on Zog all by yourself, guess what happens?
Well, and we have many. I have a video I want to put up on one of my sites. It's a series of interviews of former IRS agents who realized that the IRS was evil, that none of these laws applied to the individual American people,
right,
and they resigned from the IRS.
Right.
They did the right thing.
Yes.
But, you know, there's 100,000 IRS agents who are white Adamic men who haven't made these realizations yet.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that they're not our brother and that we should hate them because Yahweh hasn't called them to awakening. And,
right.
and what we have to be as Christians is understanding.
Yes.
We don't have to love them. We don't have to love Zog. No, no, no way.
Yeah.
We don't have to love the Zenists,
right,
but we have to be understanding of our brethren who have not received their awakening yet. And we should try to wake them up whenever we get the chance.
Right.
But in the meantime, we have to be understanding.
And that includes tax protesters among us, you know, because for one of the first, what is the problem with martyrs of the Christian identity movement was Gordon Cowell, who was a tax protester and a Christian identity advocate, right?
And you know something? He'd have done a lot better with his life if he wasn't a tax protester. I'm sorry.
Right. Yes.
It's a damn shame that he was murdered.
Right.
It's a terrible thing. But if he was not a tax protester and gave the government no reason to harm him, they probably would have left him alone, and he'd still be teaching identity to people today.
Right.
And it's I'm not saying it's good what happened. It's a horrible thing. But
right.
If you render to Caesar what is Caesar's, what reason should you give the government to hate
you? So in other words, we're supposed to grow our community, grow in the spirit, grow in our morality. Yeah, and I just appreciate and understand because the Bible also says who can make war against the beast, right?
Well, absolutely. And we should understand that vengeance is Yahweh's,
yeah,
and that these Zionists and these Edomite Jews who think that they're using this world for their own, as Paul states, who abuse this world for themselves,
their purposes, yes.
Their time is short in this earth.
That's right.
They're going to get what they have coming.
So
there is no doubt.
Yeah, we have to be patient. Vengeance is not ours. It's Yahweh's, okay? But while all that's going on, we're supposed to work toward establishing a just and moral society, at least among ourselves, to the best of our ability. And that's how Yahweh, he rewards us when we do that, okay? But if we individually try to attack Zog one-on-one, guess what? The steamroller runs right over us, okay?
Well, that's exactly what the Jews want.
That's
for us to attack Zog one-on-one. That's it. You're just playing into their hands.
Right, right. Yeah, and so, again, we have to act as brethren, building the kingdom, seek first the kingdom, and all these things shall be added unto you, okay? You don't have to be shadow boxing with Satan every moment of the day to make progress, okay? And I know the white nationalists don't like this message because their only option is to make war against Zog. They can't see any other option.
No, they can't. And the Jews love
non-Christian
white nationalists.
That's right.
Pagans and non-Christian white nationalists like David Duke, they're the Jews' best friend.
Right. Right, because they don't teach the truth about the Jews not being the Israelites of the Bible, and they don't talk about biblical law and that we're supposed to be obeying the law. Yeah, exactly. It's just simply white racism without any biblical underpinnings. Right, exactly. Yeah, and even David Duke falls into that category. I agree. All right, Bill, so I think we've got a really good handle on what Ezekiel is teaching us here in these last few chapters. I think we maybe have one episode of Ezekiel left, although I think we get more into more cogent prophecies in the next couple of chapters. We'll see. We'll see if we have one or two shows left with the book of Ezekiel. Okay.
Well, right. And we could always start Jeremiah, on a half program.
Sure.
But I'd rather not, but we could if we had to.
Yeah.
Or do a recap of what we've learned from Ezekiel.
Yeah, right.
I think that in chapter 43, we'll definitely see this as talking about the future.
Right. Very good. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Bill. It's been a pleasure again. These Old Testament books are so filled with history and prophecy. It's simply amazing. So thanks again for listening. Fellow Israelites, praise Yahweh, and Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.